Today's show is brought to you by Of A Kind, an online shop for emerging design. For more information, visit ofakind.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
Live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to Word of Mouth with Leti Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Leti Sue. And what do I do when I'm not hosting Word of Mouth? I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear on my show, and working with my clients, which include chefs, somms, big brands, startups, all those doing what's most innovative and delicious. First this morning, we're going to head to a Bloody Mary competition to drown our Valentine's Day week woes. That's right. That's all that you're going to hear about that Hallmark holiday on my show. Much hated Hallmark holiday. Well, just one more pro tip. You should avoid going to restaurants on February 14th for so many reasons. Just ask your friendly neighborhood bartender or chef or person who works at a restaurant. Today's in-studio guest on hashtag people we like, we'll welcome Sarah Jenkins, cookbook author and chef owner of Porcenia and Porchetta. Her restaurants are outrageously loved, Italian in the East Village. We'll talk mom, pasta, and surprises from Fresh Direct. We'll also wind it down with Sarah here in the studio. So since it snows just about every other day in New York City now, it hurts to go to the Green Market. So I stay in whenever I get a chance and drink soup, or I go to a restaurant and drink something alcoholic and safety blanket-like. So I did just that last weekend. Joe Campanelli, fellow radio show host, and his team over at Epicurean Group, that's Dell'Anima, L'Artusi, La Piccio, and other amazing restaurants, they hosted a Bloody Mary competition with a walk-around tasting. What in the world is that? So I give you permission to smack me now and the next time that I use a wine-ism to explain stuff. So let me describe this. Wine people, we go to these things called walk-around tastings, where the goal is to taste as many wines as possible and not get drunk. That's right. We are usually actively trying not to get shit-faced. And there's a certain Olympics involved in spitting into those spit buckets or spittoons. Hazards include, spraying objects in the vicinity, dribbling on oneself, and wine stains are difficult to get out of dresses, by the way. And finally, a great reason to get shwasted and try to forget about it, the splashback. That's right. That's when you spit into the spit bucket and then you get sprinkles of other people's, hundreds of other people's spit on your face. So walk-around tastings, despite their hazards, can be ultra-educational. I encourage you to go to one. Only when you taste a bunch of stuff, same, same, but different, can you begin to build your bookcase of taste memory. But wait a minute. We were talking about Bloody Marys. So that's why this Bloody Mary tasting was so revelatory for me. Let's just say I had greater than two drinks the night before and was ready to taste and learn and help judge. And I've never really had more than one kind of Bloody Mary in one sitting. So this is pretty exciting. I bring to you, word of mouth listeners, answers to key questions from three top picks. First, the fan favorite award was awarded to Extra Fancy. Here's Robert Kruger on their very classic Bloody Mary, Perfected.
And what's your role and restaurant?
I'm Rob Kruger. I'm a partner at Extra Fancy in Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
What do we have here?
You've got Extra Fancy's Bloody Mary. This is the Bloody Mary that I want to have when I'm having brunch. It's Tito's vodka, tomato juice, lemon juice.
Another one from
And another one. Oh, we got another fan favorite. Thank you very much. Tito's vodka. We're ringing the bell every time we get a fan favorite vote.
Now
I broke the bell.
No.
We're just running out of string on it, that's it. Tito's vodka, tomato juice, lemon juice, Worcestershire sauce, Tabasco sauce, black pepper, celery salt, caper brine. We got a little bit of ground Vicodin, fresh ground Vicodin, unicorn tears.
Wow, I love.
Unicorn tears, and rattlesnake venom.
Okay.
Rattlesnake venom.
Okay. So if I'm about to die, what am I dying for? It's a really great classic Bloody Mary.
It's a classic done extra fancy.
Right.
That's what we want to do.
It's just something about it is so well balanced and just so perfect.
It's got to be bright. It's got to have texture, but not graininess.
Not gunk.
I grind the pepper until it's just a fine powder, so it's infused in the whole thing. The horseradish has got to be at the right texture. The capers are completely blended up, the caper brine. It's the Bloody Mary that I want to have. It's got a kick, but it's not too strong. It's all about balance.
Doesn't feel like you're punching yourself in the face every time.
No, you're supposed to be. This is how you're supposed to nurture yourself with a cocktail like this. So.
So you have the most classic and sort of, to me, perfectly balanced classic Bloody Mary here.
Thank you.
Are some Bloody Marys that are fun and creative. Now let me ask, what makes a Bloody Mary not a Bloody Mary anymore? That's the big question of the day.
Bloody Mary to me has to have, if you're going to call it a Bloody Mary, it's vodka. There's other drinks that are called other things.
Okay.
It's got to be vodka as the main ingredient. And tomato, I think. Tomato, horseradish, those are the things. And spicy.
Vodka. Tomato, horseradish, spices, and vodka.
Yeah, and savory. Spicy, savory, tomato, horseradish. I mean, all the things that are in here is what I think need to be in to make a great Bloody Mary.
Great, thank
so
you.
That's what we're looking for. Thanks.
And the official judges picked Dover. And we have here Matthew Walters, head bartender, on his Asian-ish bloody that went down real easy.
All right. What's your name, role, and restaurant?
My name is Matthew Walters. I'm the head bartender at Dover, Brooklyn.
And what do we have here?
This is called the Phuket Mary. It's a Thai-influenced Bloody Mary with just tomato juice, kaffir lime-infused, Tito's vodka, Thai chili, lemongrass, lime juice, fish sauce, and little other sort of herbs and spices.
And the garnish is really interesting.
The garnish is peanuts, Thai chili, and salt. And then the garnish itself was cucumber and cilantro with dehydrated baby crab.
Yeah. Yum. Where'd you get this dehydrated baby crab from?
They're from. We got them from Chinatown. Actually, an original idea from our chef Walker Stern.
There's a lot of creativity going on. There's some really classic Bloody Marys, and then there are some, sort of sciencey ones, and then
right.
There's some ethnic ones. What constitutes a Bloody Mary to you?
To me, it's got to have sort of spice spice, tomato, and booze. That's, for me, a Bloody Mary. But, the tomato can come from many different things, yellow tomatoes, red tomatoes. We're just using a classic tomato juice in it. And, I leave it at that. Yeah.
Okay. And what makes a good one?
Again, like, for me, like, the best are really, like, spice with a little bit of a sort of interesting sort of twist on it, something that makes you keep thinking about it or wanting to go back to it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Then we have my personal favorite. Last but not least, I just had to include the Bloody Mary by Chris Melly of Alub Piccio. It was kind of brilliant and super sciencey.
Okay, so what's your name and role in restaurant?
My name is Christopher Melly, and I'm the general manager at La Pizza.
Awesome. So what do we have here?
We decided to do a Bloody Mary that was light and refreshing. We took our white Bloody Mary mix, which is on our menu normally. We thinned it out through cheesecloth, removed all the solids, and we added cucumber juice. Then we took what is essentially a gigantic soda stream, and we carbonated the drink, which is really cool because it's light. You can drink more than one of them, which is something that I really want in a Bloody Mary.
So this is a gigantic soda stream, but what is it actually? Like, can I just get this at home?
No. So basically, this is a huge carbonation tank. It's a CO2 tank that's 50 gallons, I think. It basically is attached to a meter that measures the carbonation levels, and then a piece of PVC tubing, and that connects to a little snap gauge at the end that you have to connect to the bottle. It's a lot of plumbing equipment, to be quite honest, but you can build it at Home Depot if you have the list of ingredients.
Yeah. Wow, okay. So this one's a little bit of a more innovative Bloody Mary, and the Bloody Marys that are in the competition today. So what would you say are the criteria that make a Bloody Mary a Bloody Mary and a Bloody Mary not a Bloody Mary?
I think a Bloody Mary is a Bloody Mary if it has booze in it and it tastes like tomatoes. Other than that, I feel like the floor is open for interpretation. I personally don't really like Bloody Marys because I think that they're really thick and filling, and we wanted to do something that was kind of the opposite of that.
Very cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wine walk-around tastings are a little less rowdy than this, that's for sure. My takeaway, when things look dire this Valentine's Day, go to the guy with the biggest gas tank. I'm your host, Leyte Su, and you're listening to Word of Mouth with me on heritageradionetwork.org. Congrats to the teams at Dover and Extra Fancy. Some social media info before we welcome our in-studio guest. Hashtag WOMSHOW, WOMSHOW, as usual, at @heritage_radio. I'm at Leyte Su, and Sarah Jenkins is at Porchetta NYC. That's Porchetta NYC. She usually tweets behind that, but she's also kind of sort of got at Porsena NYC. That's Porsena NYC. And now for people we like. Welcome.
Thank you.
So I'm super excited to have you on the show. I love what the Italian food that you've brought to the East Village. I always had the sneaking suspicion that maybe some of the Italian food that Americans have been used to in the last couple of decades isn't really the kind of Italian food that, say, you grew up eating when you were so lucky as a kid to have stints living in Italy with your family.
Well, I always say, actually, that I learned how to cook because I moved here in 1981 when I was 15 years old. And I couldn't recognize what was presented to me as Italian food. And I guess we all kind of know right now there was a different tradition. Immigrants came from Italy starting in the 18th century and modified their food based on what they found. A great example of that is my sous chef, whose grandmother is Italian. And she made arancini. They were from Sicily originally, and she made arancini, but she made them with long grain rice because, of course, that was all she could find when she came here.
You had this really interesting example of, so we're afraid of pastas becoming extinct, essentially, of the peachy that you told me about one time.
Right. Well, Italy, Italian food, I think when we were talking earlier, you were talking about it's possible to have a terrible meal in Italy, and it is incredibly possible to have a really bad meal in Italy. And there's a bunch of reasons for that, but one of the biggest reasons, I think, is labor costs and the way labor is organized in Italy. And it's much, much more expensive, and you don't get to fire people the way you do here. And there's a lot of benefits. There's a lot of benefits to that, but
the hidden consequences
are that, you know, what was the luxury in Italy and what kind of drove the food was, in a way, people had plenty of time to make food. Women didn't work outside the house. They spent all day preparing food. That's all changed in the past 30, 40 years. Restaurants were a really family-driven thing where the whole family worked there, and of course that's all they had to do is produce the food, and that's just not true anymore. So time is the great luxury, and you know, one of the things we always talk about in Italian food, the history or where Italian food came from, it's called la cucina povera, right? And it's poor food, and so it's making do with what you find in the forest and making do, you know, eking out your stale bread, mm-hmm. and with some garden vegetables and making an incredible soup like ribollita. And today we say cucina povera is actually a grilled steak because it's the fastest thing you can do, and time is what nobody has anymore. So you and I were talking about pici. Pici is this pasta from the Siena region, and it's sort of the height of cucina povera. It's flour and water, no eggs, so that's really poor. And
not even eggs.
Not even an egg to enrich the dough. And traditionally, it's, you know, it's rolled by hand into this very fat, irregular spaghetti, and it was sort of a competition amongst the women in the village who could roll the longest without it breaking. And then again, traditionally, because
we're in much better places now.
We're in much better places. maybe. And then it was dressed with breadcrumbs fried in olive oil. And, you know, again, because that's what they produced. They produced olive oil and you had stale leftover bread. And so you made a filling meal out of kind of nothing. And it's almost impossible at this point to find pici made by hand. You'll find them on menus in Tuscany, but they're extruded, and that's not the same thing at all. Mm-mm. You just get a big fat spaghetti. And what kind of made this dough was the irregularity of rolling it out by hand. And I'm not sure where you would go to find that at this point. It's just really, really difficult because nobody can afford to pay somebody to sit around making those.
Or you'd pay, you know, $30 for it at a fine dining Italian restaurant in New York, which is what we do, and, you know, we're happy for it.
Right.
Because we have college educated. We have people, you know, the other day, it's funny, this is something that I would recommend. Are you on LinkedIn?
I'm not on LinkedIn. I've done as much social media about as I can.
So I'll just put out, just, I did an interesting exercise the other day. I downloaded, you can actually grab all of your LinkedIn contacts out of your LinkedIn so that it's in this like spreadsheet format that just makes everything very, very clear. So then you come to this moment where you're like, oh yeah, that one guy that I studied abroad in Beijing with, who was definitely going into finance or something, and now he's a cook at, you know, DB Bistro Modern. And you're like, oh.
How did that happen?
You're like, hey. And then, you know, I Facebook messaged him. I was like, yo, welcome to the food world.
Right.
How'd that happen? amazing. So I'm congrats on the new cookbook that you're working on with your mom.
Yep. we are about to sign a contract on a cookbook called The Four Seasons of Pasta, which kind of seemed like a no-brainer to us. And there's so much interest in America now in eating seasonally. But again, that's the way everybody ate in Italy up until fairly recently, where, you know, now you can get everything. It's a global world.
Mm-hmm.
That's silly. But you can, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Italy, we actually didn't really get even tomatoes in the winter because they just weren't available.
Mm-hmm.
And you drank orange juice in the winter because that was available. And then you didn't have it in the summer. And there's some ingredients that still have that sort of seasonality to them. Fava beans is a great example. But you get pretty much everything all over.
So what people may not know about your mom is that she's actually a cookbook editor, which
cookbook writer.
Writer, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote The Mediterranean Diet.
The Mediterranean Diet, yeah. And The Mediterranean Diet Redux, as I like to call it. But
what is it actually called?
No, I'm not sure. But the Mediterranean Diet came out, and then 15 years later, she updated it.
So okay, she did.
There's two versions out there.
Well, it's remained relevant because, hey, a Mediterranean diet is, you know, the speaking of diets, well, interestingly, you know, if you eat a certain way and, you know, carbs, you mentioned that carbs may not help you to become like model thin, but they definitely aren't heart unhealthy. And there's just sort of like a way to eat that makes you heart healthy, but doesn't make you a model.
Right. And I'm not much of a nutritionist, but I know that everybody's really interested again in the Mediterranean diet because there was a big study put out in Europe last year that basically said that the Mediterranean diet was the only diet that really worked for heart health. And part of that was because it's such a pleasurable and enjoyable way of eating that people can actually stick to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always say the Mediterranean diet's based on a study done in 1962, Crete. And So those guys ate a lot of carbohydrates, a lot of vegetable fat, olive oil, and a lot of vegetables, and not a lot of meat, not a lot of fish. They were also getting up every day and going out and working in the fields all day long. So they were exercising a lot to go along with it.
Okay, that was me being hopeful. Tomatoes and pasta, carbs, and just little teeny bits of pancetta, that's all I really need.
Well, exactly, and that's a huge part of the Mediterranean diet. I mean, you know, I'm always amazed when I look at the sort of standard of protein portions in America, and the Mediterranean diet is based on no more than a 3-ounce portion of fish or meat in your meal.
So I want to also go back to, hey, why did you live in Italy when you were a kid? So your mom was a cookbook writer, and then your dad?
My father's was a foreign correspondent. Very glamorous, very dramatic.
Wow.
He covered wars around the world. And he covered the fall of Saigon and was, on one of the last helicopters off the embassy in Saigon. And we were living in Hong Kong at the time, and that was sort of his reward, was they sent him to Rome and reopened the Newsweek Rome Bureau for him.
That's cool.
Right? But what did he say? He was on assignment once, and he was, it was some dramatic film that was being filmed on the island of Corfu, and everybody was kind of joking with him and giving him shit about, you know, oh yeah, what kind of job is that? You get to go to Corfu. And he was like, listen, there's a lot of Saigons for one Corfu.
Two glamorous parents with dream jobs. What is it going to be like to work with your mom? Have you done that before?
Well, we have. I mean, we're in the same industry, you know, on different facets of it. And it was actually, you know, it took us about 4 months to write the proposal for the book. And
those are sticky.
Well, it was just trying to find a way, you know, she's kind of the writer and I'm the cook. And trying to find a way to get it so that both of our voices came through. And I think really, you know, it was just kind of sending a document back and forth, and I would fill in and round out this, and then she would fill in and round out that. So we'll see. We'll see if we still like each other at the end of this process.
The good things about moms is, for the most part, you come out still liking them.
Exactly.
That's a really nice thing. You've had working relationships with other people that you've had personal connections with. You once were in a kitchen with somebody that you had a romantic relationship with.
No.
Was it your, at Porchetta?
At Porchetta? Oh, well, yeah. I mean, my husband worked with me at Porchetta.
Oh, he did.
But that was disastrous. So that wasn't a good example.
So what we're learning is mom cookbook, maybe yes.
Right. Husband, not so. There are husband and wife teams out there that work really, really successful together. That didn't work for us.
Observing other, in light of Valentine's Day, observing other chef/owner/restaurant couples that work well together, what does it take? I mean, what is the magic, you know, formula?
I'm not sure, but probably a real balance of responsibility, you know, a real partnership. Although I have to say that a lot of times I find, and this is still a real classic stereotype, mm-hmm. the man is kind of in charge and the woman supports him.
Mm-hmm.
One example that I think is not that case at all, where they're really, really partners in everything, is Alex and Etta from Chiquito and Quinto Pino and Lavara.
Ah, who you came on the on Heritage Radio with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The studios. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to come back after a very quick commercial break and talk about how Sarah feeds her daughter.
Son.
Son. Her son, who has a very interesting name, who I
can... Nadir.
Nadir. Her son, given that she's a full-time chef owner. Wow.
Yeah.
You are listening to Born Day by Taxstar. on the Heritage Radio Network. .org.
Interested in emerging design? Check out Of a Kind, a site that sells the pieces and tells the stories of up-and-coming makers. The site has featured over 200 designers and offers limited edition pieces you can't find anywhere else, along with the studio tours, travel guides, even recipes from the designers. To find out more, head to ofakind.com and sign up for the site's newsletter.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leyte Hsu on Heritage Radio Network. I'm here live in studio with Sarah Jenkins, chef owner of Porcena and Porchetta in the East Village, delicious Italian restaurants. Sarah, it must be interesting to have a mom who's a cookbook writer and then have seen the cookbook industry from then and then to now, where you've worked with our friend Nick Fotchild on doing a digital version of your cookbook. I mean, kind of nutty how far we've come.
Well, I think, you know, the cookbook industry is a little bit in shambles, and publishing in general seems to be in shambles. And for people like my family who've been so closely tied up with writing and the written word for so long, it's a little dismaying. At the same time, as somebody pointed out to me once, it's not that the information and the transmission of information is going away. It's that the medium is changing. And I got really interested in apps and the iPad, and reached out to this guy I knew, Peter Cortez, who wrote apps and did apps. And he brought Nick Fotchild in, and we did an app called The New Italian Pantry, where we were really trying to use some of the features of an iPad, you know, like, well, I mean, one of our little quirky things is to have the temperature in Rome on the page all the time. So whatever the daily temperature is in Rome, you know, whatever temperature is in Rome, when you're on that iPad, you'll see it.
That is so cool. That's so cute.
And, you know, these are things that you can't do in a cookbook. And one of my favorite cookbook writers of all time is this guy, Jake Tilson, who's a bit of a typographer and an artist in England. And he does a lot of books with cutouts and, you know, pieces of paper fluttering out of them and mock-ups of this, that, and the other. And I loved that. I've never been able to get any publisher to get behind that, I think just because the production costs are kind of so insane.
So, wait, the cookbook is almost like an art project? And it's
exactly. And he is really an artist and a typographer, far more than a cookbook writer. But I actually know him because his family had a house next to ours in Italy growing up. And he had also, his father was an artist and a family that was very, very interested in food. So he grew up being an artist also, but retaining that interest in food.
So I would have a cookbook that's your cookbook, and then I would cut out meatballs
exactly.
And paste them onto the
exactly. Or he would noodles. Have copies of receipts from a meal he ate somewhere that would kind of flutter out like a real receipt.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like once you open the book for the first time, you're like, ah!
Yeah, right. and I loved that. And in a way, the whole iPad thing seemed to open up some of that.
Oh, my gosh. I bet that the really great there's bad cookbook iPad versions of cookbooks out there, like horrendous, and then there are great ones where the technology is invisible and empowering.
Right. Well, I think it's really interesting because I think there's a real disconnect in publishing. Publishing's kind of this big giant mega industry with a lot of people that have been very tied up to it for a long time, and they're not really thinking very innovatively. I had a friend who was working for Disney Hyperion, I think, at a certain point, and I said to her, well, is anybody talking about apps? And there was a complete disconnect in her you know, publishing house. There was, you know, Disney obviously is spitting out apps left, right, and center for mm-hmm. kids, and they're all very innovative, and there's a million and one things going on in them. But nobody was kind of trying to tie that in together. And I find that in publishing, they're all kind of sitting around tearing their hair out, like, trying to figure it out, but they're not looking. I think they're too tied to the old media, and they're not looking at how to harness the new media.
A cookbook editor that whom I know is, you know, uses Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and apps and stuff, and has an iPhone and experiments. And what always shocks me is, I mean, so he's actually a unique one of the bunch in old publishing. And what always shocks me is that there are even like CMOs who have never touched any of this stuff, and you really have to learn viscerally.
You do, and you know, I know. I don't know. I know it's challenging for a certain generation, all of this stuff. But I think that's the brilliance of the iPad and the iPhone, is that it's so intuitive that, you know, everybody talks about their 2-year-old kid swiping the iPad, right?
My mom texts now, which I'm happy about.
Right.
She's like, why don't you text me? I'm like, Mom, that's news to me. Announced. Let me know that,
that you could
you
text.
Can get my text messages right. Now. And the word app is just, it causes this a little bit of an allergic reaction. It's difficult for me because one of my big clients is an app. So when people say, what is it? I do everything I can to explain it without saying it's an app, which only serves to confuse people. But I just don't want to say that it's an app because we don't want to just have an app just to have an app.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, it's fascinating to me. My son is 6 years old and he has a game on his iPad that involves cars, that as you move them around the screen, different screens pop up, different activities happen, and I'm just waiting to be able to do that with a cookbook.
Very cool.
What if you could move a little pot around the screen, you know, and the flames would leap up around it or something like that?
Wow. Open up the iPad and now you're in a professional kitchen where you have big fire, big pots.
Right. Or you could switch it. The other scene would be like a really primitive rural kitchen somewhere, you know, with a fireplace.
Right. There hasn't been like a Mario Kart, but for cooking.
Right.
Like
right.
A different, you know, Rainbow Road versus, I just remember Rainbow Road. there's like, I don't know. I love the icy one. It's not no longer Mario Kart. This is now Donkey Kong.
Right.
Donkey Kong on Super Nintendo, by the way. Not the one that lives in arcades. Okay. So that's my childhood. So really cool. You used to write, you have a bunch of columns on Atlantic Online.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually a great trove of interesting getting in the head of a chef stuff. How did you end up writing this?
Well, Corby Kummer was the editor. He is a big editor at Atlantic, and he was involved with getting Atlantic Online, and I left a snarky comment on one of his pieces, and he then said, well, why don't you start writing for me instead of writing snarky comments, and I was so taken aback, and it never really occurred to me, and then I thought, oh, that would actually be really interesting, and I have a few things I'd like to say, and so I started writing for them for a while, and it was great. Unfortunately, I really couldn't do it as often as I wanted to, mm-hmm. and I got behind, and then I think their focus changed a little bit, but...
Cool. Well, you bring up some really interesting points in, look up Sarah Jenkins' Atlantic. What were articles where you meant to be controversial, and what were some where you were surprised at the response that you got?
Well, I wrote a piece about cooking with extra virgin olive oil, which in America everybody thinks you can't cook with extra virgin olive oil, and for those of us that grew up in the Mediterranean, where as far as we can tell people have been cooking with extra virgin olive oil for 3,000 years, is a little peculiar. But the piece I wrote was really about how people in the Mediterranean use it, why they use it. It's kind of the major fat they produce. And I wasn't really trying to beat anybody over the head or say you should use extra virgin olive oil. I was just sort of pointing out what seemed to me an unknown fact.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this litany of comments in there. sort of, you know, you're so stupid and what do you know, and nobody cooks with extra virgin olive oil and you can't cook with extra virgin olive oil. And, you know, one of the reasons we don't cook so much with extra virgin olive oil in Italy is we don't necessarily produce it in our backyard the way people in the Mediterranean do. Mm-hmm. And that was part of my point, was that it is used because it's the most common fat they have and, you know, they have access to. We have access to, I don't know, Mazzola. And so that's what we use. But if we had an olive grove in our backyard, we'd probably be cooking with extra virgin olive oil.
It's just the truth. And my mom, who's Chinese, cooks, chops vegetables with something that looks more like a meat cleaver. So, you know, we don't care about fancy chef's knives or just the classic chef knife.
Right, right.
Not everyone is French.
Right. No, not everyone is French, fortunately.
And what was the story? You brought up some other potentially controversial pieces. What was something that you thought was going to be controversial but ended up like being crickets?
Well, I kind of wrote a piece about feeling sort of lonely for mm-hmm. ordinary lives, standing in the restaurant and looking around at people who got to go out on a Friday night and mm-hmm. hang out with their girlfriends and catch up and stuff like that. And that's stuff that I just don't get to do. And, you know, it's a choice we make in the restaurant industry. There's a lot that drags you into the restaurant industry, and I'm very, very happy that I found it, and I love it, and I continue to, but every once in a while you're like, wait a minute, but I don't live a normal, you know, and part of it for me, I think, was that I never wanted to live a normal life, but then all of a sudden sometimes you look around and you're like, well, wait a minute, and I thought I might have gotten some commentary on that, but really nothing, you know? I got a bunch of other chefs saying, I agree with you, you know?
wah-wah.
Right.
It's like, here I am pouring my heart out, and you're going to really, you know, lay on me for the olive oil? My last question for you before we wind it down is, what's it like to put food on the table for your son, and how do you do that? Like, what are the key tips and tricks for working moms?
Well... You know, I'm a food person, and so I care very much about what my kid eats. At the same time, I find that what you eat and what you don't eat is kind of the first way that you get to gain autonomy as a kid. So kids are kind of primed to not eat anything. My thing is sort of, you know, we eat whole foods, right? Whole foods are what available. There's not a lot of junk food in the house. Without being insane about it, you know, if we go out to a restaurant and he wants French fries, he can have French fries.
Yeah.
But we're not ordering in franchise fries.
Yeah.
He eats a lot of fruit, and I just kind of make sure we have a ton of that around. He's a big pizza eater, and I think pizza, if you make it at home or you make it with good ingredients, is a great, can be super nutritious. And then the one thing I wanted to make absolutely sure was that when we traveled to Italy, he could eat in restaurants with me in Italy, and so I have him completely hooked on pasta with tomato sauce.
Nice. Excellent. Right. You sit there with your pasta and tomato sauce while we have everything else.
Right, exactly.
You just shush.
Exactly. But yeah, you know.
Where do you shop?
Well, we're big Fresh Direct fans, actually.
Fresh Direct?
Yeah.
So you you would think you would order from your purveyors or... That's just so surprising.
Right. Well, you know, in theory, I suppose I could be lugging stuff out of the restaurant, but that just seems like another step. And, you know, and I promise I'm not being paid for Fresh Direct here, but, you know, they have worked very hard to source local stuff. They sell Satter Farm vegetables. I get, like, you know, Old Chatham yogurt from them. And at the same time, you know, I can get trash bags and washing up liquid and all of that, you know?
Wow.
So.
Little known fact.
Right.
About Sarah Jenkins and empowering to all of us. So we're going to wind it down with the last couple minutes in the show.
Wind down.
I just really like my sounds. So, I love the piece where you basically slipped into this one pasta recipe using red wine, that it's okay to use corked wine in cooking.
Yeah, I suppose that's slightly controversial, and there are people out there who will say, no, absolutely, you can't use corked wine. I always find that by the time you're done cooking with the wine, the corked is gone. You know, the corked flavor has been overpowered by something else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think it's an excellent usage of corked wine.
Hmm. That's definitely a controversial one.
Yes.
But it's just that people are so... I've never tried it. I'm going to try that recipe. People are just a little bit, just maybe sometimes unnecessarily strict about some stuff.
Right. And, you know, I have to say that is the one thing that I would encourage everybody to be with mm-hmm. food is to be flexible and open and experimental, because rigidity is where you get lost.
You built your own wine list at Porcena.
I did.
How has it evolved?
It's been 3 years. I'd like to say it's evolved a lot more than it really has. I did start including French and Spanish wine and Greek also. I decided to kind of open up to the rest of the Mediterranean. And the Greek wine has probably been the most interesting and the surprising to me, because it's really, really delicious. It still seems very obscure to me, and I'm still trying to get a handle on the regions and the varietals, but I love the flavors. And I have, I grew up basically drinking Chianti, and that's still kind of my favorite red wine, you know?
High acid and goes well with everything that you cook.
Exactly.
What were your top three? You know, it's not every chef owner also does the wine list.
Right.
And I'm...
Well, it's interesting to see some of the wines that really sell. We get Montepulciano, Rosso di Montepulciano, and made by Caterina Day, and that's been on my list since the get-go, and it's still probably my most popular wine, whether I pour it by the glass or pull it off by the glass.
Why is that?
Well, I'm going to assume that Montepulciano is a name that has some familiarity.
Mm-hmm. It was fun to say, too.
Right. So that's part of it. It's pretty reasonably well priced. I want to say it's about $45 a bottle on my list.
Mm-hmm.
Might even only be 40. And it's a really well balanced, great tasting wine. Now I've sat on some other stuff over time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, I have a pretty, I think that people, Italian wines are, how do I say this? I don't know, they're complicated and obscure in a weird way, and somehow because I grew up with them and I worked at a winery in Tuscany at one point, I have a little more familiarity with it, so they don't seem that confusing to me. And I think people here get really caught up in, I like Cabernet Sauvignon, or, you know, this is what, you know, I drink a specific varietal. And Italy is not so much about specific varietals. I'm not sure if I'm saying the right thing here, actually.
It makes sense. It's just, I hear you, it's quite all over
the
place.
It's terroir, you know?
Yeah, it really is these random grapes you've never heard of in this little tiny town, and that town is very prideful. And
right, and they make a great wine.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of stuff that, if you don't know much about wine, kind of lingers on my list. And I try to sort of correct myself sometimes, but then I'm tasting wine and there's some incredibly obscure varietal from, you know, here, there, or the other where that I've never heard of, and I like the wine and I'm just like, I have to have, you know.
One tip for a restaurateur who does not have the budget to hire a professional sommelier to build a list. One tip to get them started.
Drink the wine and your food together, I think. I mean, your wine guys are all going to be eager to help you anyways, but I actually think it's a magnificent opportunity, and we're always kept so segregated from the wine, right?
Yep.
Wine is something else, and yet, again, classically in Europe, wine is really never separate from food. The two go together.
Thank you so much for joining me, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
This is Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue on Heritage Radio Network. That was just Sarah Jenkins, chef owner of Porcena and Porchetta in the East Village. Tune in next week for Chef David Burke live in the studio. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.